soul, my friends, it was inevitable in the sermon series on Isaiah that we were going to need to do a little historical review at some point. And today is that day. As I sometimes say here, we're going to need our thinking caps on today. Here's a cartoon for you about learning history. Dad says, "Why did you flunk history, kid?" And the kid says, "Well, the teacher asked me about stuff that happened before I was born. Who cares about that stuff, right?" And next one, this is just about learning in general. The one guy says, "My head hurts." And next guy says, "That's because there's too much in it. If you learn one more thing, it'll explode." Apparently that was a new piece of information for him right there. And then finally, one more. The teacher says, "And I know you're as excited as I am about today's lesson. You can see the reaction to this. I sure hope that's not what's going to happen here in this setting today. But we are going to have to work at this one a little bit. But let me tell you, the work will be worth it. The work will be worth it." In order to understand what's happening in Israel of Isaiah's day, we have to have at least a basic grasp of what happened in the days leading up to it. And that's what we're going to be doing today. So, hey, we've already had one quiz this morning on Psalm 23. I'm just going to keep going with this quiz theme for a bit. Okay, we'll start out easy. Okay, really easy. How about this? Can you tell me the names of the two major sections in our Bibles? The Old Testament and New Testament. And then I've asked this question to you a lot over the years. What should those sections really have been called? The Old and New, Old Covenant and New Covenant. Covenant is an agreement between two parties. Think marriage covenant, a serious agreement. All right. The Bible is divided into two sections that really should have been called the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. That would have been a better translation for us and really would describe quite well the contents of those two sections of the Bible. The Old Covenant, Old Testament, was primarily about a covenant God made with a group of people called the Israelites, and the New Covenant section, the New Testament, is about a more recent covenant that God has made and continues to be making with any person who would turn to him in humble submission and repentance of sins. Covenant made possible by the blood of Jesus Christ. Okay, so let's talk about that Old Covenant for just a bit, the one that God had with Israel. Next question. Who was the leader of the Israelites when God offered that covenant to Israel? Good guess? Moses. Moses. So the Israelite people came out of Exodus, or out of Egypt, in that Exodus from Egypt, camped around Mount Sinai. There was an Abrahamic covenant too, by the way, Wes. The big one was with Moses, though. Israel was camped around Mount Sinai, and God called Moses up to the top of the mountain, and there God gave to him 10 commandments, and actually a whole lot more of what qualified as the terms of this covenant agreement God was proposing to make with them, laws that they would be asked to follow. And God then said this to Moses. This is from Exodus 19. "This is what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." So Israel's side of the covenant was to obey all the laws God gave to Moses for them. God's side of the covenant was to make Israel his treasured possession, to make them a holy nation, one that God would dwell within in a special way. They would be given this great land and be protected and blessed and so on and so forth. That was the covenant agreement. But it came with a warning. We read this section of scripture here recently, but let's look at it again from Deuteronomy 8. God said to Israel through Moses, "Observe the commands of the Lord your God, walking in obedience to him and revering him, but be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, laws, and decrees that I'm giving you this day. If you ever forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and worship and bow down to them, I testify against you today that you will surely be destroyed." This was a very serious covenant. that Israel was being offered here, and which of course they agreed to enter into. It was either going to be incredibly good for them, the God of the universe protecting them, leading them, living with them essentially, blessing them. That would be true if they obeyed. Or it was going to be incredibly bad for them. They would be destroyed, it says there, if they disobeyed God's laws. Well, God was the true king of Israel when they entered into this covenant agreement with him. However, after some time, the Israelite people began to ask for him to appoint a human king over them as well. God told them it wasn't a good idea, but they kept asking, and eventually he said, okay, here's your next question. Name of the first king of Israel. Name of the first king of Israel. King Saul, yes. Thank you. You know how to work it, Tom. Yes, King Saul is the first. So the books of Kings and Chronicles in our Old Testaments name 42 different kings after Saul, if you count the kings on both sides of the divide of Israel, which I'll explain in a moment. So here's your next question then. Judgment call on this one. Did the majority of the 43 human kings over Israel, counting Saul, did they obey the terms of God's covenant with Israel, or did they disobey it? Did the majority obey or disobey? Yes, the majority of these human kings that got put over Israel disobeyed God's laws, and in fact, according to the judgment of the biblical authors, the vast majority of them greatly disobeyed the covenant from the time of that first king, Saul, in 1025 BC until the last king in 586 BC. So God makes this incredible covenant with Israel, and they insist on not just having him as king. They want a human king so they can be like everybody else. And the human kings that followed for over 400 years, for the most part, led Israel into terrible sin and disobedience. And this was not insignificant covenant breaking either. In some of our recent sermons here on Isaiah, we've talked about some of the sins that Israel was involved in. Let's look in a little more detail here. We need to mention that the disobedience started out almost right away. Saul was certainly a troubled king who lost God's favor over time. Now, David came after him, and he's the one who got it right, although we know that even David was not free of significant sin in his life, but David did have a true heart for God and repentance for his sins, and for the most part, he led Israel in right ways. And though there were other good kings who came along down the road after him, David kind of became the ideal, right? The standard of the Israelite king, the true Israelite king. Directly after David came his son. David's son was named Solomon. Good. Well, Solomon started out great, but he ended terribly. 1 Kings 11 tells us that King Solomon loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their god. One last question for you. What is the very first of the Ten Commandments that God gave to Moses as part of this covenant? The very first of the Ten Commandments. No other gods before you. No other gods before you. You will not worship any god except the one true God, right? So here we are, just a few kings into this experiment of having a human king in Israel, and that king, Solomon, had polluted Israel with worship to false gods. Pretty unbelievable given all we know of Solomon's life up to that point. But, you know, really, it's almost like he looked at this God who had established Israel and gave Solomon his power and his wisdom and his wealth and really figuratively spat in God's face. I'm not going to take the time to explain this, but as a result of Solomon's sin, Israel became divided in two. The tribes of Judah and Simeon to the south and some of the tribe of Benjamin, with Jerusalem as their capital, formed the kingdom of Judah. And the rest of the tribes to the north formed a kingdom that retained the name Israel. And each of those two divisions then had their own king, and they were often in conflict with each other. And the sin of Israelites and their kings in both the north and the south got worse than Solomon's sins. At least at times it did. Here's a snapshot for you. One of the kings of Judah, when Isaiah was living and prophesying in Jerusalem, was named Ahaz, King Ahaz. And the book of 2 Kings 16:4 says of King Ahaz that he offered sacrifices and burnt incense to false gods on the hilltops and under every spreading tree. NIV Study Bible notes on that verse tell us that the people who lived in the areas surrounding Israel, the non-Israelites, often viewed large trees as symbols of fertility. And they would build shrines under these large spreading trees. And in those shrines, they would perform, it says in the NIV note, immoral pagan rites. And I think that we can probably guess what kind of immoral pagan rites connected with fertility were going on under the large spreading trees. And King Ahaz was involved in that kind of thing. Over in 2 Kings 17, it says of the Israelites, north and south, and their kings, that they forsook all the commands of the Lord their God and made for themselves idols cast in the shape of calves, Asherah poles, which were wooden images of a false goddess. They bowed down to all the starry hosts. They worshipped Baal. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters in the fire. They practiced divination and sought omens and sold themselves to do evil in the eyes of the Lord. Lastly, 2 Kings 23 tells the story of one of the good kings in Judah. In fact, he was the last good king who went about the effort of trying to reform his kingdom and get it back on target for God. And he had all the items and places that were being used to worship false gods in Judah removed. And it says in verse 7 of that chapter that he also tore down the quarters of the male shrine prostitutes that were in the temple of the Lord. That's how bad this had gotten. Well, of course, there were Israelites who did obey God over that 400-plus year history of the Israelite kingdom. But many were disobedient. And yes, there were some kings who tried to obey God during the 400-plus years of the Israelite kingdom, but many were disobedient, and the disobedience was not minor. So when we have been going through Isaiah here, and we're reading his complaints about all the injustice going on in Israel and the innocent blood spilled, and we hear his stern warnings of terrible judgment coming. Now you know the backdrop to all of that. This was not a minor mess going on in Israel that God was complaining about. This was a major league mess. And God had warned Israel what would happen if they disobeyed him. We read it earlier. They'd be destroyed, it said, he told Moses. And Moses told them. And certainly those words of warning from God would have been easily accessible even to the later Israelite kings if they'd been paying attention to their scriptures. So this evil in Judah and in Israel had been going on for hundreds of years by the time Isaiah lived, and the destruction that they had been warned would come if they disobeyed was finally about to hit. A few weeks ago, I told you a story about when I was in the Bethel College Choir, and I've got another one for you today. Each year, at least back when I was in the choir, we took a tour, and it rotated, the destinations rotated every year. So one year you'd tour the Midwest, and then you'd tour the East Coast the next year, and then the West Coast the next year, and then once every 4 years, they would take a tour, a two-week tour in Europe. just happened to work out in my time in college there that the Europe tour came along my senior year, which was just a super way for me to end my college time. So we took this two-week tour and visited and sang at churches in Sweden and in Denmark and Norway and Germany. And after the concerts then, you know, we'd break into little groups and go stay in the homes of the hosting church, you know, and they'd arrange that ahead of time. And a lot of really neat experiences there. You can imagine we did do also a fair amount of sightseeing since we were in Europe. And our choir conductor, Dr. Berglund, who was actually quite a taskmaster, provided for us a pretty good amount of freedom on these sightseeing stops. However, Dr. Berglund was also always very clear on when we needed to be back to the bus when we were out running around, after we were out running around and looking at things, okay? And he repeated this clearly again and again, that if we were not back to the bus on time, he would leave us. Said it often to us, which was pretty effective. We were on time. We had been warned. And so it goes that on one stop, that really was more like a stop for lunch in a little shopping area along a highway we were traveling on, shopping and food, a gal who I will name Rebecca, which is not her real name, though I'm actually quite sure I could say her real name without much harm here, but we'll call her Rebecca. Rebecca found some shops to shop at in this shopping area, and Rebecca liked shopping. And Rebecca lost track of the time as she was shopping. So when the time came for us to be back on the bus, everyone was aboard except Rebecca. And Dr. Berglund, sitting in the front row of the bus seats, looked at his watch impatiently, and we waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes. No Rebecca. The rest of us getting increasingly nervous about this situation. And, okay, this was before cell phones. We couldn't just call her and tell her to hurry up. No cell phones. Didn't really know where she was. 10 minutes passed, 11 minutes, 12 minutes, no sign of Rebecca. Dr. Berglund looked at his watch one more time, and then he said the words that we had been dreading we would hear. Driver, let's go. College student Rebecca had been left by herself somewhere in the middle of Western Germany. And I can tell you, the tour bus was quite quiet for the next 30 minutes. Well, Rebecca did get back together with us, and she was okay, thankfully. I'm not exactly sure how that happened. I remember people saying that she called the family from the church who she had stayed with the night before, and they came and I know that they did come and pick her up and brought her to our next stop. I'm not quite sure how she would have had their phone number, so maybe Dr. Berglund was involved there somehow, but maybe not, I don't know. Can you imagine making that decision as the choir director, leaving a 20-year-old girl alone in Western Germany? I would guess that he heard about that from her parents. But one thing that you cannot say is that Rebecca had not been warned. She had been warned. As all of us had been. We had been warned clearly and repeatedly that a very bad consequence would come if we were late to the bus. She was late, she got the consequence. And I say this story by way of illustration for what was going on in Israel in Isaiah's day. However, to make the illustration more accurate to how the Israelites had been behaving and how God had acted here, you would really have to tell the choir trip story in this way. Dr. Berglund warned us what would happen if we were late, and Rebecca was late. But Dr. Berglund waited for her until she got back on the bus. And he warned her again. And then at the next stop, Rebecca was late again. And Dr. Berglund waited for her until she got back on the bus. And then he warned her again. And then at the next stop, Rebecca was late again. And Dr. Berglund waited for her. And this continued again and again and again until finally Rebecca was late. And Dr. Berglund said, "Driver, let's go." Sin of the Israelite kings started early, and it continued regularly and grievously for over 400 years. And finally, God was done. It was time for the warned about consequence, the destruction, to happen. With all that said, We can now turn to our Isaiah passage for the day, if you would like, please, to grab your Bibles. And as we have been doing again this week, no slides on our main passage for the day, so please do grab a Bible. If you didn't bring your own, black Bibles are in the chairs available for you. Get up to find one. Feel comfortable to do that. Isaiah chapter 7 in the Calvary Bibles is found on page 685. Just a second to get there. Page 685, Isaiah 7. And the passage starts out in verse 1 there with this. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. All right, I want to explain that verse. So it says, when Ahaz, son of Jotham, was king of Judah. So remember, divided Israel. Sometimes the name Israel was applied to both kingdoms, but typically that was just used for the kingdom to the north. And Judah, again, was the name given to the southern kingdom. Judah also was the name of the predominant tribe in the southern kingdom, the tribe that King David had come from, the tribe of Judah. So Ahaz here is the king of Judah in this chapter of Isaiah. Ahaz is the king we read about earlier who had offered incense to false gods on the hilltops and under every spreading tree. And there were other evil things that Ahaz did. So now you know who Isaiah had for a king for a good share of the time that he was writing his prophecies of destruction. Should be said, though, before we read on here, that the two kings of Judah that came before Ahaz, however, had been good kings. And they respected God. And the one who came after Ahaz was a good king. So God was still with Judah and Jerusalem to some extent here. And the conversation that we're about to read between Ahaz and Isaiah may have happened prior to Ahaz's worst sins. We don't know for sure. The conversation certainly seems to have been happening at a point where Ahaz could have gone a different direction and chosen the path God wanted him to choose. Okay, so that's Ahaz in verse 1 there. Look at the verse again with me, and I'm going to show you a map then, and we can talk about the other guys mentioned there. Verse 1 says, when Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. And now we'll look at a map, and the writing is really small, so I will use my pointer. All right, our reference point, as usual, is Jerusalem, which is right there. Jerusalem again, the capital of Judah, which is the southern kingdom, which actually extends down in here, kind of gets cut off. Here's the northern kingdom of Israel. And then up here is Aram, which was mentioned in this verse, and their capital city, way up there, Damascus. Okay? Now, at the time of the events of Isaiah chapter 7, there was a superpower forming in the east over here, not on our map, called the Assyrians. Not the Syrians, but the Assyrians. The people who are on our map knew that the Assyrians were coming, and that they were coming with ill intent, and they were trying to figure out how to handle that. So the northern kingdom of Israel allied itself with the king of the kingdom of Aram, King Pekah from Israel, King Rezin from Aram, allied, formed an alliance, and they decided we're going to try to come together so we can fight off the Assyrians when they come to our land. They really wanted King Ahaz in Jerusalem to join their alliance, but he was more worried about the danger from Israel and Aram for his kingdom than he was about the Assyrians, and so he actually decided that he was thinking about forming asking the Assyrians to help protect him from Israel and Aram. That didn't sit too well with Israel and Aram. And so those two kings decided they're going to go into Jerusalem and they're going to try to depose King Ahaz and put someone on the throne there who would go along with their plan. We're ready for verse 2 now. It says this, now the house of David, Judah, was told, Aram has allied itself with Israel, or you might see the name Ephraim there, which is another name for the northern kingdom of Israel. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out, you and your son Shear Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the launderer's field. Say to him, 'Be careful, keep calm, don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of Pekah, the son of Remaliah. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, "Let us invade Judah. Let's tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it." Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. That will not take place. It will not happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus, capital city Damascus. The head of Damascus is only King Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim, Israel, will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son, King Pekah. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. All right, so now we know that Ahaz was not a good king, but I said earlier that he may not have been all that bad up to this point. And remember, the two kings in Judah before him were good, and so it certainly looks as if God is still wanting to protect Jerusalem and Judah here. And so he has Isaiah go to Ahaz, and we know from elsewhere, try to talk him out of making this alliance with Assyria. And instead, he asks him to trust in God, and in the word he was getting from God there through Isaiah, that if he would trust in God, God would protect him from Aram and Israel. Isaiah asks him, the end of verse 9 there again, to stand firm in his faith in God. The verse says, if you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. So the message is you don't need to fear Aram and Israel. Let's keep reading now, verse 10. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz through Isaiah. Ask the Lord your God for a sign. So a sign to prove that God would protect Judah from Aram and Israel, whether in the deepest depths or the highest heights. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, I will not put the Lord to the test. Okay, I don't have time to offer an explanation of that there, but God didn't like that response, okay? And you'll see that as we keep reading, verse 13. Then Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David. Again, King Ahaz is the representative of the lineage of King David, the tribe of Judah. Is it not enough to try the patience of humans? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. You're going to get a sign whether you want one or not. And many of you will recognize this next verse. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. And the name Emmanuel means God with us. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and we'll call him Emmanuel. And if you have been around the church for a while, you know what that verse is referring to, right? Birth of Jesus Christ. The first chapter of Matthew quotes this verse from Isaiah in describing the birth of Jesus, who was born to the Virgin Mary. However, when these words were first spoken, they also had another meaning. I'm going to tell you what that meaning is. But I need you to trust me when I say that if I give you the full explanation right now of how we get to this meaning for this prophecy, I would probably lose you, all right? It's a little too detailed for and lengthy for this point in the sermon. I am attempting an explanation of it for you in these small group study guides, so you will get to look at some of that material. But so as not to bog us down here, I'm just going to tell you what the meaning of this prophecy was when it was originally spoken. At least this is in the opinion of some commentators I read, and I agree with them. We do need to read the next couple of verses of that prophecy before I can explain it to you. So let's start over with verses 13 and 14, and then I'll hit the next two, 15 and 16. Here's verse 13 again. Then Isaiah said, hear now, house of David, is it not enough to try the patience of humans? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. verse 15 now. He, the baby named Emmanuel, will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste, and you can stop there. So here's the explanation of these verses. Isaiah, and again, I'm not giving you the background here. I'll show it to you in the small group study, guys. Isaiah was about to get married to a second wife, his first wife having died earlier. At the time of this prophecy, he was not yet married to her. She was still a virgin. In the next chapter, chapter 8, Isaiah describes how he later had a child with this woman after they married. The prophecy in chapter 7, I believe, applies to that child. And as it says in the prophecy, before that child would be old enough to know right from wrong, Aram and Israel would be overrun by the Assyrians, and King Rezin and King Pekah would be dead. Look back at verse 15 and 16 again. The baby named Emmanuel will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. So let's recap this whole scene now. God told Ahaz through Isaiah, Aram and Israel would not be able to defeat Judah, and so Ahaz could trust in God for this rather than go make a treaty with the Assyrians. Ahaz did not heed those words, and he also rejected God's invitation to ask for a sign to prove that God would protect him. So God gave him a sign anyway. A boy was going to be born to Isaiah's soon-to-be wife in the near future, and by the time that boy was just a few years old, Aram and Israel would be too weakened to do any harm to Judah ever again. The boy's name would be Emmanuel, again signaling to Ahaz that if he would just trust in God, God would be with him. The initial meaning of the prophecy of a virgin giving birth to a boy named Emmanuel. By the way, all these things did happen within just a few years of this incident in King Ahaz's life. Aram was wiped out by the Assyrians. King Rezin was killed. And the northern kingdom of Israel, all those tribes up north, the consequence finally coming upon it for breaking God's covenant over and over and over again, Israel, the northern kingdom, was also wiped out at that time. Lastly, we know that God wasn't happy with King Ahaz either, right? For his poor response to him in this conversation with Isaiah. There was going to be consequence for Ahaz too, but not to the level that happened for the northern kingdom. Look at chapter 7, verse 17 now. The Lord will bring on you and on your people, King Ahaz, and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim, Israel, broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. And Assyria did come into Judah as well and plundered many of the towns there, but it was not able to conquer Jerusalem. Jerusalem was spared because even though King Ahaz was off target, God still was with Judah and Jerusalem at this point. God with us, Emmanuel. Certainly looks like Ahaz could have spared Judah from all of that suffering that they endured there at the hands of the Assyrians if he had listened to Isaiah and trusted God and stopped sinning and so forth, but Ahaz didn't listen. And so it went with most of the Israelite kings, both kingdoms. We just read of the destruction of the northern kingdom. God did indeed stay with Judah and Jerusalem for a time after that. King Ahaz's son turned out to be a very good king, and there would be one more really good king in Judah down the road. But all the others in between and after continued this pattern of ignoring God and doing the terrible things we learned of earlier today. And eventually God got to that point of saying enough to Judah as well. The next superpower from the east after the Assyrians were the Babylonians. The Babylonians came in the year 589 BC. They laid siege to Jerusalem for 2 years and eventually destroyed the city and the temple. They captured and killed the last of the kings of Judah, a bad one named Zedekiah. They hauled the bulk of the people off to different lands, making them live there, some in slavery. And 2 Kings 25:21 says, "So Judah went into captivity away from her land." Destruction had come upon both the northern division of Israel and now upon its southern division as well. The Israelites had failed in their side of the covenant with God. The institution of a human king on the throne in Israel had failed. There are 2 points of application that we can take from this material for our own lives this morning. The first would be this. Don't be Rebecca. Okay? Don't be late to the bus. And really, that point is the same as we've kind of been getting in all of these sermons on Isaiah, at least part of the point of each sermon. Don't be disobedient like so many of those Israelites were back then. Submit to God. Care about his commands and about trying to obey him. Don't be like them and bring destruction upon yourself. So that's an obvious implication or application point from today's material. Boy, the second application point is one we actually could really spend a lot of time on if we had the time to do so this morning, which we don't. But it is this. So the whole call to King Ahaz from God there was, trust in me, even when your enemies are closing down on you. Trust in me. I'm with you. Emmanuel, God is with you. That was the message. And this is a great point of application for us in our lives too. We have times when we feel like the enemies are closing in on us, right? And maybe we, like Ahaz, start to look for human solutions to our problems when what we need to do most is to trust in our God. For he is with us when we are trusting in him. Bring your attention back to chapter 7, verse 9, where God said to Ahaz, if you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. We need to keep our faith. Our trust in God in good times and in bad. Keep our focus on him, and then he'll pull us through. So those are two application points we can draw from our reading in Isaiah today. But what I am most excited to say to you here now at the end of my sermon and this historical review of what was going on in Israel before and during and after the time of Isaiah, what I'm most excited to say to you is this. So yes, the institution of a human king on the throne in Israel failed, and a terrible, deadly destruction had come upon Israel, and all looked dark. But allow me to read to you now the first 7 verses of chapter 9 of Isaiah, and this one will be on the screen for you. A prophecy God gave to Isaiah as Israel was moving into those dark days. Chapter 9, verse 1 says this, "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." All was dark, but there was light coming. Having a human king over God's kingdom clearly didn't work. God's kingdom needed an eternal good king, one who would always bring about justice rather than injustice, one who was both human and divine, and one such king was coming. It was time now for God to do something new. The old covenant was passing away, but a new covenant was coming. A second fulfillment was on its way for the prophecy of a virgin giving birth to a child named God with us. And the next time I deliver a sermon to you, let's think of the season we're entering into here, we're going to do some more talking about that second Emmanuel. Praise the Lord.